How many read the book? At least the first three chapters.
Right.
Of The Bible Makes Sense. Okay, the first chapter. Okay, I won't assume that you have intimate knowledge of the first three chapters. We'll talk about those today. And they're sort of a preliminary in getting into the biblical literature. It's one of the better books I've ever read on, as an introduction to the Bible and a method of approaching it. And he has three or four other books that follow the method that he sets forth here pretty exactly, pretty well. He has a set of three tapes in our tape library on Deuteronomy where he puts his principles that he states in this book to work. He has a book on the land. He also has a book on the prophetic imagination, which talks about the conflict, the eternal historical conflict between God and Pharaoh. Pharaoh meaning any force that manages and oppresses human society. He is a student of Hans Walther Wolff, who both Brueggemann and Wolff have been here to lecture at Light conferences. And they both have the same sort of methodology in that they look for the central credo, the central fact of the proclamation of the scripture, of the central fact of the memory, and then they use what he'll call in here historical imagination in making it speak to us as the present insiders, the present people of God. There are going to be three parts, one for each chapter here. One is to talk about the perspectives that he names in the first chapter. And he contrasts the biblical perspective. He says what the Bible intends to do is not to give, well, let me put it positively, the Bible intends to give you a perspective, a way of looking at things, I think in the language that's been used here in the past year, to produce a particular kind of think with as an inheritor of the memory, as an insider. And that particular biblical way of seeing, way of thinking, way of knowing is opposed to many dominant sort of ways of thinking that we have in our culture. So we'll talk a little bit about those. The second thing is beginning the work of the insider, the one who is inside the memory and the faith and belongs within the identity of the people of God as we do. And the key word for that second chapter is historical imagination. Now those two words are in some ways are in a tension because imagination oftentimes runs free of history. And what Brueggemann says is in order to do proper biblical study and to come to a proper understanding of what the Bible is saying to us, one has to discipline one's imagination with the history, with the concrete historical events of our memory that tell us what God is like. On the other hand, history alone does not make one an insider, but it's the position of faith and the imaginative use of our story and our memory that makes it alive for us. Okay? So that's the second part. The third part are the first steps of Bible reading for an insider. And essentially what it does, it focuses rather than on the content, it focuses first on the literature as a fact. Before you go into the content of the literature, you have to step back and look at the literature. So hopefully we'll go through all three of those things today. And I'll review points. Please feel free if you have comments or something strikes you or you have questions to interrupt, and we'll just do it as we go along. If we don't get done with this, we'll continue it on Friday, and we'll spend some time Friday. The other chapters, once you've got the first three, come a little easier, and you can begin to think like, well, with this historical covenantal way of thinking, and it makes more sense, and maybe we can, when we get to the end of the week, we can engage in this sort of historical imaginative work that he outlines for us and participate in biblical study that way. Okay, let me first put up the four models or the think-withs, the perspectives that he names. First of all, the first one is the scientific what are the other words?
The existential
and the transcendental.
He uses a couple other words for this.
No, that's industrial. That's modern industrial. He doesn't touch on shipping particularly.
Doesn't doesn't he? Okay. Does he?
I think he had three words there.
And it's kind of a characterization. It's probably, maybe we can question this. And then the fourth one. Is a historical covenantal. Is that how you say that word, covenantal?
Yeah, sounds good.
Okay. You that have read it, let's just get down some of the characteristics of this one. Let's start with the first one here. The scientific industrial modern. He says that's pretty pervasive. Maybe if you can describe characteristics or say places where you run across that way of thinking. The one that hit me was school. The phrase he uses here is quid pro quo, which I think means something for something, or this for that. It's great to be able to throw around Latin phrases. Something for something, okay? School, you know, you do the work and you get the grade.
It's interesting that particular Latin phrase is perhaps the only one that you find businessmen and politicians using a lot.
Business, okay.
they know what quid pro quo means.
That makes sense in the industry.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Your worth is based in your productivity.
Okay, productivity.
Performance,
competitiveness. Any other arenas where you've run into this?
It places a strong emphasis on mastery.
Mastery. Expertise.
Knowing and controlling and managing.
Skill, control. Okay. Any religious manifestation of this? Is there a theology that goes along with this? Something for something?
Retribution.
Okay. Retribution.
Or propositional truths.
Okay. I remember being told in one of the operating principles in the campus group I was in college was that the kind of miracles and the kind of spirituality one has in your life is directly proportional to your amount of faith, as if it was something that could be measured, right? You've heard that too? The word that makes the most sense to me, and it's a word I borrowed from Father Capon, who wrote the Hunting the Divine Thoughts, and this is a good, his is a good book that sort of speaks against this point of view. The word he used for this is transaction. It's saying about the same thing as something for something. It's like a bank transaction, a payment. And that there's always a constant temptation to turn what we receive as gifts and grace into a sort of transaction. The Catholic Church, after the late Middle Ages, was in that position where you could buy forgiveness and, you know, monetary contributions and particular acts of piety were the things that earned you merit. And they even had a kind of a quantitative word to describe. What Brueggemann says here is that this is not biblical. Okay, just flat out, not biblical. Any other comments on this one? It's pervasive, and it's one that we always find ourselves up against. How many people, when rotten things happen in their life, say, what did I do wrong? What did I do to deserve this? It's falling into this sort of mentality. And the biblical stories had to cope with this sort of temptation many times.
Yeah. One of the things that way back when we were discussing community and we were, you know, flying high on these community concepts that bothered me is that most of the close communities I've known operated on the principles of that first thing, scientific industrial, you know, quid pro quo,
yeah,
and not this kind of caring, nurturing sort of thing that we were focusing on in that discussion of community way back in the beginning.
Okay.
I mean, I think that happens here, but in the outside world.
Well, I think it may be a temptation always in communities to reduce things to get out what you put in. And there is a certain element of that when you say, one doesn't work, neither shall they eat. There's always a danger of falling into completely transactional. There was a particular important word, I think, to sum up in one word, it might be this. Okay, let's go on to the next one, the existential.
What was the word that summed it up?
Transaction, quid pro quo, something for something. Okay. Existential, anybody can give some buzzwords or experience in that respect? It's a little, it's not quite as obvious sometimes. Okay. Good afterworker. Where's that from?
Hemingway.
Okay.
You're the master of your decisions or your destiny.
Okay, you're very, very personalistic individual.
Subjectivity is true.
Okay. Subjective. And that relates to something Brueggemann says, is that it becomes non-historical. That you really can put any interpretation on the meaning of things that you want to. And it's individualistic, it's really up to you. And his evaluation of it is that it's non-historical. And the importance of that will become more obvious as we go along here. Because down here, history is more important.
One thing that's interesting that struck me when we were talking about that is that existentialism came through as really kind of an extreme reaction against the first thing.
Okay.
I mean, for example, there isn't this emphasis that the individual controls his or her fate at all. I mean, there's this sense of uncertainty, risk, and the absurd. But if you took most of the basic propositions of the scientific industrial model and just threw them into reverse, you could come up with something close to existentialism. And I think it's significant that existentialism flourished after World War II and under a philosopher like Sartre, who was a Marxist and essentially deeply opposed to capitalist culture.
It's not fair to make it out as very, well, it's important to realize that it's a very desperate sort of reaction.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a lot of confidence. I mean, it's not I'm the master of my fate sort of thing at all.
Okay. It may be, in that way, being non-historical, it may be almost futureless, right?
Well, yeah. I mean,
the importance of the future as well as the memory.
You kind of live in the moment or in the present moment.
Yeah, okay. Any places where you've run across that? You mentioned it, and Dave, you're going to...
No, I can clarify that. I've run across that ourselves?
We've run across the quid pro quo model in school, in job hunting, in competing for different things. I suppose sports is a good example of that. Where do we run across the manifestation of this?
Well, the closest form, it seems to me, is the undergraduate romance, philosophical, not with a person, but you have the undergraduate caught up in the system of grades, competition, and everything, and then in his or her heart of hearts, there's this little Camus book, and you're nurturing this existential fantasy of yourself.
Yeah. Undergraduate rebellion.
And it doesn't, I haven't seen real existentialism survive very long beyond the undergraduate level in many people.
Okay, undergraduate
other really. Philosophers.
That's good.
How about some of the charismatic churches, for instance?
Okay.
Not necessarily all of them, because not everybody puts the complete thing on.
I'll put that there because it's very definitely individualistic and subjective, maybe non-historical. It may relate to this one when we get down to it.
What's this one?
The next one will be the transcendental. But he says these aren't ironclad categories, and there may be, you know,
interplay between all of them.
He mentioned the youth culture, which is, I always get a kick out of that, that phraseology, but maybe there's something to that, that maybe it's connected with undergraduate rebellion.
I think a lot of times when you find people feel that they're failing in category one, their depression puts them in category two.
Yeah, that's not, okay, that is a, it can be a personal reaction to this as well as sort of a movement. Okay, that's... I sense that it might be afoot in some of this self-fulfillment, self-actualization, pop psychology, as yeah, something like that.
Yeah, that's an utterly debased form. I mean, you know, if you could imagine the most degraded form of Christianity, that would, I'm okay, you're okay.
In my impression, it's lost the desperateness of the original kind of existentialism.
Right, whatever truth was in genuine existentialism has been pretty much just chucked way out.
I'm okay, you're okay. George Farrell, in trying to use the same words to contrast that with it, with a Christian, you would say, I'm not okay, and you're not okay, but that's okay. That's
You're talking about the theology of the Crystal Cathedral?
Here? It's possible.
Positive thinking?
That life is a subjective, individualistic kind of, you know, positive outlook on things. That becomes that particular thing, disconnected from community, disconnected from history, becomes your salvation. Positive thinking, I suppose that would go there. Okay, any other comments? Now that's a religious manifestation of that. There are others. One thing that's one phrase I've always heard that's real suspect is that love your neighbor as yourself means that you really have to love yourself before you can love your neighbor, and it turns into a lifetime distraction of seeking self-fulfillment, and you never really get around to your neighbor. That may be a religious heresy. His point is that's not biblical either. Okay. Anything else on the existentialist view? The transcendental. I think there's a lot of religious manifestations here. Otherworldly. Someone want to relate their impression of the meaning of what he says there?
I get the idea it's something that makes you less human rather than more human, or it kind of puts you in another level of existence.
Okay, detached.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll put less involved, less human.
Pie in the sky, Christiana.
Okay.
Which is the Christianity I got most of the time growing up.
High in the sky, where the end result, the end that all the means were aimed to was heaven.
Well, at some point God is going to blow the whistle, and the game is over, and all the good people go to the picnic in the sky, and all the bad people go to hell, and we'll see who scored, how, you know, it'll be clear who the best scores were, who were the losers, uh-huh. And then the real life, you know, what then
real
reality
life.
Will begin after, you know, the world has come to an end. What's really real?
The world is the veil of tears. Root reality is beyond it. There were times when the Christian church engaged in theology like that, but again, it was a desperate situation. Whereas the only hope, the only way to make sense and preserve elements of this view were to totally deny and stand against the present order, And you see evidence of that in the book of Daniel, the apocalyptic writing, the book of Revelation, where the situation was so precarious that one had to engage in the transcendental view just to preserve the community. When it's engaged in comfortable times or in times where work can still be done, but it's chosen not to, then it's not biblical. Any other comments on that transcendental?
It seems to relate to the question of whether or not the church should be involved in politics or spiritual matters at all.
All right, good, yeah. And this view would answer no, that the church is what, ought to save souls, to preach the gospel, and that whenever you enter into the realm of politics, which is the realm of people and history, you're going outside your bounds. And that is so unbiblical. It is the big unbiblical point here is that it's history denying. Whereas this may be non-historical, maybe no judgment at all in history, this definitely says that history is not where reality is. And that's unbiblical. Okay. This is the view that he says is the biblical one. It's the one we're going to try to struggle to make our think with, our understanding of reality. And he says that the Bible's primary purpose is to help nurture this in our own minds. And there are four characteristics here that go with this historical covenantal model of thinking. One is that the literature gives you an identity, okay, and it's communal, in contrast to the existential is very individual, and this one, which is many times individual. It gives you a memory, meaning that history is very important. He says it's a precise historical memory, and both those words are important. Okay. The third thing is that it gives you a future, that the identity and the memory. The covenant gives you a pattern that you can expect to continue on in your future and in the future of history. God has done things in the past. God will do the same thing in the future. And these are related. They're kind of historical continuum. And then the fourth thing, and I think maybe it's related to identity, is that you have a call or a vocation. And that once you have an identity that stands you apart from the world's way of seeing things, it gives you a precise historical memory of past. What happens is that your future looks different than it did before, and your calling in the participation of that future is very radically different. Okay, let's just talk about that one for a while. Any reactions to that?
Would he apply the same model to other faiths, do you think, or can we apply that to other faiths?
I don't know. I would say probably not. Any that are rooted in Judaism or in the might be. I don't know if there are many religions outside of those, the Christian, Jewish, and Islam that are so connected with historical events. And there's always a movement in those to separate it from historical events.
One thing that bothers me, I've gotten the untouched ones, I don't know if they'll deal with that, where he comes out on specificity.
Yeah.
And it's good in some ways, but it does suggest that God singled out the Israelites, the Jewish nation for his covenant ultimately with humanity as a whole, mm-hmm. through Christ. And it does tend to deny the validity of other religious faiths that are deep and broad. I mean, you know, India, Hinduism, which is more ancient and in some ways far more deep, or more deeply profound mm-hmm. in some of its religious insights than Judaism. But that specific, you know, the God is historical and specific, not general and multiform, mm-hmm. seems to push all those other religions into the shadow and then means that, you know, everyone's kind of got to convert to Christianity at some time. I don't know. This is what bothers me with that.
I don't think you're alone in that. There are other discussions in our Old Testament group when we talked about Abraham receiving a promise, a particular person going to be the medium through which all people will be blessed, you know, through Abraham and Sarah and their descendants, was offensive to many people in that discussion. And I don't think there's any way to mitigate that, to make it less. And it's one thing that the church also has. The church claims a historical memory in Christ crucified. And claims a particular status. It might be, hopefully it's a suffering status as the people of that particular covenant. But yeah, it is precise historical, and as a result it excludes many things. And it is offensive.
Well, this seems to go with the territory of history that individuals are singled out to either represent or to initiate causes and movements.
Yeah, just from the number of people claim to have initiated a movement. In other words, if no one had or thought of religious experience of God, you know, before the Hebrews, it'd be no problem. Then it would be clear, you know, this is the origin. I mean, let's face it, these guys did invent the wheel. But there were traditions that even predate, I mean, they were not the first monotheists on the globe. And it's just simply saying, well, now we've got to make a value judgment, and the Jews get an A, and the others get C+. You know, nice work, but I'm just part of exploring the offensive. I mean, a lot of good things in that historical specificity that one really responds to, and it's just, to me, the thing that's hard to get around. And he's right, it's an unsophisticated to do, you know, the sophisticated thing is that, well, ecumenical, everything, let's pour it all into a potpourri and, you know, everything goes.
Dan, when we talked about Ephesians that time, Dan or Leonard? Well, okay. You were mentioning that you felt that God revealing himself in Christianity and in the Judeo-Hebrew tradition, it was just a little corner of a much greater reality revealed here. Do you still believe that? I wonder you. If you would care to comment on Eric's criticism, I'm curious.
Well, I don't know how it relates, because Ephesians is probably part of the offense, because Ephesians claims that all the whole cosmos will be united under the lordship of Christ. So it isn't saying that Christ is one way among many. What was helpful to me, I went to a study of this with a professor of comparative religion who was also a Christian, and said that showed how the Bible lives in the tension between exclusiveness and universality. That is, a person of the, you know, the Hebrew Christian faith who live in that tension, since it's a specific. At the same time, there's a whole strange universalism paradox.
That clarifies it.
The production of this or the nurturing of this historical covenantal perspective is the job of the Bible. That's why we've got it. The Bible is not there to give us answers, it's to give us point of view. Was that helpful for anybody? Okay. Now he does some things in talking about the Bible that I have found really helpful. One is that he tries to draw the parallels. It's new speak. But he has bad news for people. He says it's hard work. He says that some of the things he says are that as a preliminary to begin to nurture this historical imagination, or the historical covenantal perspective, you have to have a sense of Bible chronology, and that's one of the things we've been doing in Old Testament. Okay, and this is just hard work, the hard work of history, as Donald Sutherland, my medieval literature professor, said at University of Iowa. He said, it's just the hard work of history to memorize dates and places. And in the book, he gives you a little resource of the kind of books you can go to for that. Chronology, geography, international affairs at the time. And then for the people of Israel, the major events and institutions. And hopefully those of you who have been in Old Testament have recognized we've talked a little bit about these major institutions like the monarchy, the temple, Jerusalem, the major events, the exile, the beginning of the monarchy, the exodus out of Egypt. International affairs, you know something about the movement of the northern peoples of Babylon, Assyria. Now they would always put pressure on Palestine, how Egypt would put pressure on from the south, and the sea people, the Philistines and Hyksos, would come in from the east in the Mediterranean. Chronology, patriarchs 1800, King David 1000, the exile 600 BC. Geography, you know, the generic map of Palestine. So that's the hard work of it. It's not easy to do that. Once that is done, he says the next thing, and this is a word that he makes a large use of, is historical imagination. I'll just read a section from that part here. By imagination, I mean an openness and sensitivity to the pulses of meaning that can be discerned in reflection upon the historical experience, the memory preserved in the historical community. The imagination of the biblical community plays primarily with images which have come from this particular history. Thus, Pharaoh comes to be a symbolic reference to every form of oppression. Bread comes to refer to the strange gift of nourishment which happens in the desert. And the stories cluster around these images so that every oppression-liberation event is a new dealing with Pharaoh. Every surprising gift of nourishment is another miracle in the wilderness where starvation is wondrously avoided. Such imagination, of course, opposes that kind of preoccupation with facts and history which believes only what can be proven and which limits belief to that which is empirically demonstrable. Imagination is the gift of vitality which enables the believing community to discern possibility and promise. But the imagination of an insider is always an historical imagination. It is not just any innovative thinking. It is inventiveness driven and shaped by particular historical experiences. It is the capacity to return again and again to the concreteness of the past of this historical group, Israel, the church, and to discern their new meanings. Thus, the ideas of historical and imagination seem to move in opposite directions. Historical without imagination tends to be arid and not compelling, but imagination without historicality tends to turn into undisciplined fantasy. He says that the Christian vocation, one of the Christian vocations, is to nurture the historical imagination. And by that means, you become and act like an insider, one with an identity, a memory, a future, and a vocation that is counter to the existing culture. Okay, any, Tom?
Well, it seems like in studying American history, our country's been real good at some sort of historical imagination and seeing ourselves as the new Israel, and we are the promised land, escaping from Pharaoh, which has been Europe at times, and now is Russia. Seems like there's always a danger if you're not historically accurate in using that imagination, because it seems like in this country it's been severely abused to justify all sorts of things in the name of you know.
Yeah, or maybe when the pilgrims sat in their boat off of Massachusetts, thinking imaginatively and historically, realizing that this was the repeat of the coming into the promised land, that has maybe become perverted, and we've lost track of the shape of our history. And whereas instead of being Israel and Canaan, we may now be Pharaoh.
But there, you know, there are some people that say as soon as you start thinking like that, it will be abused. I mean, any kind of this. Yeah. Any kind of historical imagination
will always tend to become abused, and will never. You'll never be critical of yourself if you always see yourself as God's chosen people.
Another contending ideology that still has a skeleton of biblical patterns to it is, ironically, Marxism. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of Marxist ideology has been lifted out of the Bible and transmuted in a way. I mean, if we're talking about perversions of biblical truth in the modern world.
Yeah, Marxism definitely has elements in it of Pharaoh and the oppressed people of Israel in the brickyard, the proletariat and the bourgeois. Okay, right. What do you think, if you had to apply this, would you be able to judge what's going on here with the criteria he sets out? If we were to preserve what he says, the historical imagination is the way to do it, what went wrong here?
Well, we got too good of an imagination and not enough history, I guess.
Okay, the imagination maybe has been undisciplined. Or that it has not continually been critical. Maybe originally, the dream of America as a promised land, the dream of a classless society where everyone is equal and everyone lives according to their needs, have somehow been lost, and history has proved them to be fantasies, or have proved that, I don't know. Okay. Danger of domination by imagination is great.
I'm confused. Is he saying that to interpret the Bible and apply it at present time to this construct? Or is he using this to try to figure out what was going on then and what it means? I'm confused.
I think in some ways he is saying that the memory we have can talk about our future and our present. And this is the means by which we do that. What we'll get to with the concentric circles here, when we look at the literature, we'll maybe say more about that too.
When you said the danger of imagination, in other words, history would be a constraint and a discipline on this imagination. We keep these, when you mean history, do you mean these things like the facts, the dates, the...
Mm-hmm. Maybe facts. Events.
The problem is, not to make too complicated a factor, but modern historians would say that's not really a solution, because all history, even the facts and dates, is a highly selective memory. Okay. And to say, well, the problem with Marxism in America is that we haven't looked at enough of the facts. Doesn't really get at it, because I'm not sure that's it. I mean, Judaism didn't look at all the facts. You know, it somehow it missed something in the pattern. I mean, in other words, you go over, I think the problem in misapplying the biblical pattern in America and in Marxism is not so much that we need to go out and empirically dig up some more facts, but maybe we've selected out of the pattern of biblical history certain forms and ignored others. And that we get a hold of our imaginations by repossessing the pattern, because even the Bible says that faith tells you what facts to see and how to see them.
Yeah, I mean, but it's not just any facts.
Right.
But it's the selected ones that are part of our memory and identity that
right.
will. Okay.
And so that means that the pattern is telling us what facts to look for.
All right.
And that we can't correct the pattern by pulling in a lot more facts and readjusting the pattern.
Okay. That when we speak about the historical, we're not talking about just facts, names, dates, and places. We're talking about a particular pattern that was observed with the eyes of faith. And most people would say that history is never objective, right?
Right.
It's always selective. It's always an interpretation. And I think Brueggemann's bald assertion would be that we have a particular specific one that's going to shape everything here.
I'm not sure I like the word memory, and that comes mainly because people tend to remember the good about themselves and not the bad.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a tendency then to screen out the times when they were wrong.
Okay, that's probably...
And I don't have a better word to suggest, unfortunately, but...
Yeah. The one thing that's really odd about the biblical memory is that they don't screen out
yeah.
the bad. That is, whereas the epic tales of the Assyrian kings and Hammurabi, and you know, everybody puts on their little speles all the great things they did. Most of the people in the Bible are their jerky behavior is recorded very openly.
Yeah, what is it, Shell in his second article brings that out in the most abysmal, awful experience of the concentration camps in the war. What Jews said to each other is, remember this. I mean, that, you know, in a sense, it's the opposite of what you're saying. When you're in the worst conceivable experience that could happen to you, that, you know, something you would not want to remember. I mean, if we get out of this, forget it. What was said was beyond everything. The first and foremost obligation is to never forget. That this is happening.
But I think what's happening then is they're forcing themselves to remember that. And I wonder if that is really truly being remembered or if it's...
Maybe I could make a faith assertion, is that they Jews have the mastery over this historical imagination. If there's anything we can say about the Hebrew, the Jewish faith now, is that this is really something that they do. Much of Jewish culture now is presented in terms of literature that is memory. That they are the ones who are preserving the memory of this awful ethnic experience they went through in the Holocaust. And it's maybe a testimony to this historical covenantal mindset that they really, maybe they do have a real firm grasp on it, and that their memory works in ways that are more, have more integrity than our own. At least I would maybe just put that out as a proposition. Okay, I want to draw the big target on here now. Okay, we talked about the first steps of being an insider, nurturing the historical covenantal perspective is nurtured or is formed by this nurturing the historical imagination. The Bible's purpose is to produce the historical imagination. That is, and one of the most obvious characteristics that you kind of forget about is that it's mainly narrative. Now we don't share facts and ideas like that anymore. But just the fact that 3/4 of the Old and New Testament are narratives indicates something about the historical imagination that is tied up in concrete events. That it's best expressed in narrative, and this is one of the things that we have trouble with. We tend to like to speak systematically, you know. God
humankind, salvation. You know, the old systematic categories just didn't exist there, and we have real trouble thinking in the narrative. And that's maybe an indication of our difficulty with the historical imagination. We usually, when we approach the Bible, we don't make any attempt to look at the literature as the first fact. What we usually do is go chronologically, you know, like Bible school or Sunday school, you start with Adam and Eve, or with the days of creation, and you go to Adam and Eve and just sort of progress as if the events were a history. You know, and you get to the Tower of Babel, and you get to Abraham and Sarah, and you go through the patriarchs and Joshua, and it's just this slow march all the way down. But there are all sorts of difficulties with that, in that that's not the way the literature produced it. That's not the way the memory worked. So right off, just to say, that's not a good way to approach the literature. That's not a good way to approach the Bible. Second, to do it consecutively, which is worse, that is to start at Genesis and go through. It's roughly in chronological or consecutive order as far as the events go. But that's another mistake, and you'll realize that as soon as you get to one of the prophetic writings and the particular context and history, especially like Jeremiah, you have to jump all over to make any sense out of it. He'll begin talking about something and then go back to a 10-year earlier period, and then it'll be memoirs that a secretary writes down, and then go back 20 years, and it's just nonsense. So it doesn't work to go consecutively through the Bible. And anyone that has started with good resolve to read the Bible and has started at Genesis 1:1 can testify to that, that it's excruciatingly painful and it's tough to get meaning out of it. The third way that we often do it, that Brueggemann takes issue with, is to contrast Old and New Testament. And if there's one thing he does, he paints the similarities between the two. And when I draw this diagram on here, the diagram applies to both Old and New Testament. The fourth and probably the most destructive way of doing it wrong is this kind of leveling attitude towards Scripture, where every word counts the same as every other word. It's sort of like it's an oracle, and you can just flop your Bible open, and when the verse says go and do likewise, that means as much as Christ crucified. It's not true that there are that it is not an oracular book. It is not one where every word, every phrase, every verse is as good as the other. And we, even in the church, say that when we have our most important scripture lesson from one of the four gospels, and we all stand up for it, and we base oftentimes a sermon text on it. And all those, the chronological view, the consecutive view, the contrasting Old and New Testament, the oracular view, none of them pay any attention to how the literature was written and when. And that's the point where Brueggemann wants to start. He says you have to know something about the literature before you can begin to make any sense out of it, and before this historical imagination can result. And what he does, he begins by making concentric circles here. We might not be able to get through all of this. Maybe we'll be able to start with this on Friday at 9 o'clock and have a little more discussion. I'll just kind of present here. What he calls the primal narrative is at the center of both Old and New Testament. Now, you that have Bibles, let me give you a couple verses to look up. Deuteronomy 26, 5 through 9. And 1 Corinthians 1, 23. All right, somebody else look up Deuteronomy 6, 20 through 24. Somebody else, 1 Corinthians 15, 3 through 8. Who has Deuteronomy 26?
5 through 9.
Yeah, read that. Oh, listen, what this is the primal narrative. It is the credo, in the words of an Old Testament scholar, the creed. Okay?
And you shall make response before the Lord your God. A wandering Aramean was my father, and he went down into Egypt and sojourned there, few in number. And there he became a nation, great, mighty, and populous. and the Egyptians treated us harshly and afflicted us and laid upon us hard bondage. Then we cried to the Lord, the God of our fathers, and the Lord heard our voice and saw our affliction, our toil, and our oppression. And the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm, with great terror, with signs and wonders. And he brought us into this place and gave us this land, a land flowing with milk and honey.
That's an old liturgical text. When you brought your thank offering, you would stand before the altar and say that, and then you'd plunk down, and here is the first fruit I bring you in gratitude. It was the story of the Exodus. And that credo occurs in a number of other places. The Deuteronomy 6, somebody read the 20 through 24. Does anyone have that?
When your son asks you in time to come, what is the meaning of the testimonies and the statutes and the ordinances which the Lord our God has commanded you? Then you shall say to your son, we were Pharaoh's slaves in Egypt, and the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand. And the Lord showed signs and wonders, great and grievous, against Egypt and against Pharaoh and all his household before our eyes. And he brought us out from there, that he might bring us in and give us the land which he swore to give our fathers. And the Lord commanded to do all these statutes, to fear the Lord our God for our good always, that he might preserve us alive as at this day.
Okay. The essential kernel, the nut, the center of the Old Testament narrative is that creed, the Exodus and the promise of the land. You'll find it throughout the Old Testament in expanded or contracted form. The most contracted, I think, for I brought you out of the land of Egypt. It begins the Ten Commandments. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt. The New Testament is no different. It's built around the primal narrative here. Somebody read 1 Corinthians 1:23. Chapter 1, verse 23, 1 Corinthians.
But we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and folly to Gentiles.
Okay. Somebody look up 1 Corinthians 15:3 through 8. Christ crucified. Another primal narrative is, or a confession of faith, is Jesus is Lord. Another very early one, just the three words. A New Testament scholar called this the kerygma, and I think that's just a Greek word meaning the same thing as the credo, the center. Okay, 1 Corinthians 15. This is a little more expanded, but still a very basic primal narrative.
For I delivered to you as of first importance what I also received, that Christ died for our sins in accordance with the Scriptures, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day in accordance with the Scriptures, and that he appeared to Cephas, then to the 12. Then he appeared to more than 500 brethren at one time, most of whom are still alive, though some have fallen asleep. Then he appeared to James, then to all the apostles. Last of all, as to one untimely born, he appeared also to me.
Okay, do you hear that as a very basic sort of statement of the Christian faith? It's very similar to the creed we use. The three characteristics of the primal narrative that Brueggemann names are, first of all, it talks about an act of God. Second of all, it talks about it without any kind of apology or explanation. Paul just says bluntly, it's foolishness to people to hear about it. The third thing is that the event has the potential or has actually changed history. Not only your own personal history, or the person that makes that creedal confession, but also the history of them as a people. Okay, those three characteristics. And again, in the New Testament, you can recognize different places where, like in 1 Corinthians, Paul is talking about all sorts of practical issues. But finally, he has to come back at two or three different points in this letter to Corinth and rehash the kerygma, the basic truth the basic confession of and their identity. And their identity and their memory becomes the basis for their future and for their vocation. The next level, I'll take this off, is the expanded narrative. And there are other memories grouped around this primal narrative, and they draw their meaning from the primal narrative. The Old Testament expanded narratives are the story of Pharaoh and Moses. Do you recall how you in the Old Testament reading group about how the writer obviously got delight out of the uncertainty and doubt of the contest? You know, there was the plagues, and then the Egyptian magicians did the plagues, and it was with a lot of relish that the storyteller told the story. There's also the story of Abraham and Sarah and the other patriarchs and matriarchs. That also are related and draw their meaning from this promise of the people to the land. You know, Abraham and Sarah promised to live in this land that I will lead you to. The Genesis 12, the story of the patriarchs begins with, "Go to the land which I will show you." One thing that's that's often a characteristic of this expanded narrative is the kind of agonizing over the meaning of it, and will this come to pass? Will the promise of the land come to pass? Will people understand the meaning of Christ crucified? This agonizing and this sort of uncertainty, it's a good... And if you know that that's a characteristic, you can begin to see the kind of the way that the writer builds it into the story. Abraham and Sarah get old without children, you know. All of a sudden you've got this uncertainty about, well, is it going to happen? And then Isaac is born. And then Abraham's told to sacrifice Isaac. Isaac is disinherited, has to run off to Syria and live for a while. Joseph is sold down into Egypt. There's a famine. All the sort of uncertainty that exists here. There's the complaining of the people in Exodus, the hardening of Pharaoh's heart, all ways of helping to explain and expand the primal narrative. The Christian counterpart in the New Testament is first of all, the earliest stories were about the events of the crucifixion, beginning with coming into Jerusalem, the story about the controversy with the Pharisees and the Sadducees in Jerusalem in the temple, the agonizing in the garden, the uncertainty of the disciples, they're falling away, the passion story, the earliest, and then not too long after the passion stories, the stories of the Gospels. And the Gospels, you'll recognize, relate to the primal narrative. Jesus is Lord with the kind of literary device of the disciples never understanding, Jesus doing things like turning situations of death into life, you know, people who are sick and injured, diseased, were met by Jesus with this kind of prefiguration of the resurrection, the crucifixion and the resurrection. Okay, that's the expanded narrative. The next...
Joel,
yeah.
I don't understand the part about the Gospels. Parts of it are expanded narrative and parts of it are primal narrative, or I don't know where that fits in.
Okay. What's going on here is that the primal narrative that we heard from 1 Corinthians, the few very short sentences about Jesus, about Jesus' life and death and resurrection, become the focal point, the organizing point for the other memories, and the way that those memories about Jesus are selected then and written down. New Testament scholars have for a long time observed that whereas the four Gospels all each go their own way in many ways up to the week of the Passion,
they're all very consistent in their style and the events that they talk about from Palm Sunday on, or from the Sunday of the Passion on. And the explanation they have for that is the earliest story. Those were the earliest stories that were circulated, and the earliest form of the expanded narrative. And what these were expanded further with other memories. And Mark was the earliest gospel. There were other stories of the sayings and doings of Jesus that Matthew and Luke used along with Mark. John developed, you know, put down an expanded narrative that's really radically different from the other three. But when they all arrive at the Passion, the memory becomes much more coherent and much more similar in all four cases. Does that answer your question?
Kind of. I'm just, to me, in my mind, much of the Gospels would have been primal narrative. And I can see where a lot of it would be expanded narrative. And I was wondering where.
Okay. I think the only way to, and Brueggemann himself says that these are not ironclad categories, that there's movement in between them. The only value in making the distinction is that this, the primal narrative, Christ crucified, becomes the focal point and the organizing pin around which the whole story is told. Okay? So when you see that the narrative leads up to that in a dramatic way, it probably would fall in that category. Okay.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay. It's 12 o'clock. I'll just quickly go through these other two.
What?
10 o'clock. 10 o'clock. Okay. We do have till 10:15?
Sure.
Okay. Did I misspell?
No, it's fine.
You go to another level of narrative called the derived narrative. And this whole complex becomes the basis for further reflection on further events and further memory. And in the derived narrative are events subsequent to Moses and Joshua, the story of the kings in the Old Testament, the story of the Acts of the Apostles, of Peter and John and Paul. That seems to be pretty straightforward. Any questions about that? The final circle that he has is one that includes a lot of different kinds of literature. Literature of institutionalization. Theological reflection. You're laughing. Instructional, vocational. Institutionalization is that once a people has become a group with an identity and a memory, there are always events to begin to cope with present dangers, with problems that come up within the community and identity, with threats from the outside, with questions about one's own, the meaning of the identity in the particular situation. And those things in the Old Testament can be seen in the laws of Israel. The Ten Commandments and the other statutes and ordinances and what he calls the dreary writings of Exodus 25 through 40, the book of Leviticus, Numbers 1 through 10, 25 through 36. I suppose included in the institutionalization would be the writings about the temple, about how do you organize the religious life. Also included in that would be probably all the genealogies, which were a concern of the priestly authors of the exile, because they were concerned about purity of dissent. It was all institutionalization sort of concerns. On the New Testament side, I'll just draw two tablets there for that. You find a correlating type of literature in the letters 1st and 2nd Timothy and Titus. They're concerned about talking about the leadership of the church. What is a bishop like? What about presbyters? What about the organization of the church? And those letters are probably not—they're not very numerous in the New Testament because the time the literature expanded was very short. And we have some literature. Most of the modern day theology, Christian theology, occurs in this sort of circle, although it's outside the canon. There is a sense in which we still do theological reflection, writing on institutionalization and vocational, devotional, instructional kind of writing. Okay, so Timothy over here. Theological reflection. There is nothing in the Bible like we would call theological reflection, like systematic theology. They didn't do it that way. They did it in terms of narrative, and for people, it's very frustrating many times for people who want it laid out. What is God like? What is human nature like? Because you can't just go to the section marked God or human nature. You have to make sort of an artificial extraction from the whole narrative. And in a certain way, that method has been given up by Old Testament scholars who used to, you could predict the table of contents of all those books because they start with God, humankind, salvation, covenant, arrange the books like that. Von Rad, who was an Old Testament scholar, changed that by trying to go and look at the literature as it grew. Okay. The one that would be closest probably to any kind of mature theological reflection, we've talked about this in Old Testament, is Deuteronomy. In the New Testament, probably Romans, or maybe Galatians. The vocational, instructional, this was an interesting category, Brueggemann. Most importantly, are concerned about making the narrative live in specific situations. And he puts the prophets, the prophetic literature, the didactic literature like Proverbs or Job, lyrical, like some of the poetry, the Psalms, visionary, which we call apocalyptic, which is a way of bringing this to bear on a particular historical situation. Over on the Christian side here, in the Christian literature, vestiges of hymns are found in the Old Testament and the New Testament, like Philippians chapter 2, the story about Jesus humbling himself and God's exalting of Jesus, where I think it starts, have this mind among you which was in Christ Jesus, who was equal with God, did not regard equality. In Greek it has signs that it was an early hymn. Revelation, that's a visionary kind of thing. Obviously 1 Corinthians, when he says, now about eating food sacrificed to idols, now about adultery, now about this, now about that, now about speaking in tongues. A lot of Paul's concerns fall in that area. And as I said, oftentimes it's very necessary to recall the standard, as Paul does three times in the first letter to the Corinthians, to say, well, I remember there's only one foundation on which things can be built, and that is on Jesus Christ, or we only preach Christ crucified, or I passed on to you that which I first received, that Jesus, we read that. Okay, again, notice that it's mostly narrative. Notice that there are parallel sort of growth of the literature from between the Old Testament and the New Testament. And so there, you would probably find a continuity there. And if you look at the similarity between these two primal events, God brings out of bondage into freedom. God is the home bringer, the freedom giver. That is very consistent with the primal narrative of the Christian creed. And that one would expect that these narratives on this side would also begin to feed and produce literature on this side too. The third thing about this circle is that there is a level of importance that is high here and decreases as it goes to the outside. We have inherited a group of scriptures, tend to, without thinking about it, regard them as all the same, all the books, because all 66 books are in the Bible, therefore we have sort of an oracular view. But consistently through our 2,000 years of history, I've always had a higher regard for things closer to the inside of the circle and less of a regard for out here. That way, that's one of the ways that Luther could say that James, which was a book that belonged out here in the didactic instructional, probably didn't belong in the New Testament. It's the way that the book of Daniel, the book of Esther, which are books in this area, were regarded by the Jews as maybe not belonging in the Bible. But that the story of the Exodus was the most important, the Torah, and it was the earliest collected, the earliest afforded any kind of authority. And the same with the Gospels. The Gospels put in the front, the Gospels were the primary lesson of the church. And that the debate about the inclusion of some of the letters and authorship has continually gone on the further they are to the outside of the circle. Okay. Any questions on that?
Thought just came to me during Holy Week, and we have Passover meal, we'll be celebrating the Jewish primal narrative, and then Easter Eve, which is the way the Christians Passover will celebrate third, the New Testament primal.
Yeah, those things which occur yearly in this circle. Recall this, and the parallels, and the fact that the meal that Jesus ate on that Friday, or on that Thursday, was this meal, affords another connection right at the hub of our memory. Good point. Thanks. Is this, like I said, the purpose of this was to help you understand what you were reading in the Bible. And the purpose of that is so that you nurture a historical imagination. And we'll talk more about that. The rest of the book is maybe examples of the exercise of that historical imagination in looking at the narrative. Has this made sense for anybody? Given your reading of the Bible in the past and what you know about it, does it make sense as a way to approach it?
What helped was a good context behind it for me was Dan's talk on the living word, way back then, where he contrasted the Hebraic way of communicating truth with the Greek, the whole logical thing, you know, either something is true or not true, this whole way of perceiving truth in terms of it's either a true fact or an untrue fact, and a whole different, you know, conception of I mean, this is the, well, that'll misstate it, I suppose, but the Jewish equivalent of the Aristotelian syllogism.
Yeah, maybe, yeah.
The story is, you know, it's not just, and I guess it's the difference between a people that believes that the truth unfolds in time, between a people that had a static, as the Greeks view of existence.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and the invitation to be an insider is to enter into here and make this the center of your consciousness is really a difficult and a foreign one for us. But it has to do with what Luther said about the living word, and literature not being propositions, but that it's something that becomes part of your identity, and that the primal narrative is something that you don't need to apologize for. It's grasped by faith. And it isn't a syllogism.
Thinking through it gives us a tool to discern, like, without being snotty, but Hal Lindsey would spend all of his time on the outer circle.
Yeah.
Without being judgmental.
Yeah, but it is a constructive way to evaluate that sort of thing.
Evaluation.
Yeah, because by this scheme, that sort of interpretation of visionary literature says, well, it's not really dealing with the primal narrative, with the most important thing. Yeah.
I think just as a literature teacher, in one sense, this Hebrew notion of truth is very modern, in the sense that we have a deep sense in the 20th century that existence is in time, historical.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all our science, in that sense, all part of our science is back with the Hebrews, that truth unfolds or that. But as a literature teacher, when you're teaching a story or especially a novel, we have the term plot, which is what you have in the primal narrative. That is a sense of the structure, the architecture, the fundamental architecture of the whole book. And if students in class haven't read the conclusion, they can miss most of what happens in the beginning. I mean, knowing how the story comes out, knowing the whole frame of the story, can completely alter your sense of the beginning of it. And so that one problem with dealing, say, with a long book in a lit class is that people are just reading it, you know, in sections as you move through. You really, it's hard to deal with the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Because the conclusion can change the whole sense of it. And that's, again, I found a resonance in that. Knowing that primal narrative, the plot summary in the middle, is what you need to read all the elaboration, the episodes, the whatever.
Yeah, and it is interesting, too. This doesn't occur in any logic place like at the beginning. You'll find it embedded, first of all, in Paul's writings, because they're the earliest. The Gospels really are expanded. And in the same way, the Old Testament, you have to dig into the fourth or fifth book in a particular little paragraph before you find signs of this primal narrative. Well, we'll continue this Friday then. So keep on reading through the book.